Jordan, bottom line baseball right now, Bob Costas, baseball season is right around the corner. It's one of the best times of year. What still attracts you and your love to the game of baseball today?
I think the atmospherics of baseball, even as you watch spring training games now, with only a handful of fans in the stands, you're reminded most of the country is still in a wintertime mode, and you're reminded of springtime, sunny Florida or Arizona. Just kind of the rhythms and sounds of baseball. May not be the actual starting lineups that you're likely to see from these teams when they're playing games for real, but just the sounds of baseball, the pop of the ball in the mitt, the crack of the bat, what little bit of crowd sound is there now as we creep back toward normal. All that is heartening and it's appealing.
Same way, are you a fan of teams being able to kind of agree on whenever to end a baseball game? Do you wish you could see nine-inning spring training games, or are you kind of just like, however long it takes to just get till opening day right now?
I'm in agreement with almost everything they did last year, and they may have to do during spring training or even during the season this year. Short of running the bases clockwise, I am okay with almost anything that makes sense, that gets them through pandemic circumstances. Now, those circumstances are going to be less dire, by all accounts, as we move through the ensuing months. But for the time being, they've got to be mindful of it, and it makes sense, especially from the standpoint of pitching. Some of these guys have not pitched competitively since 2019. Others only got into parts of 60 games. So building up arm strength and getting a gauge on how many pitches, how many innings you can count on these guys for is an important part of this spring training in a way that previous spring trainings haven't been.
Well, over the years, too, we've had some guys like Craig Biggio play their entire career with one organization. Do you think we will ever see that again with today's game?
Ever? Sure. I think there'll be some. You know, Freddie Freeman could be one in Atlanta. Aaron Judge could be one with the Yankees. I'm forgetting some. I guess you're thinking about younger players just coming in now, so maybe that doesn't count Yadier Molina and Adam Wainwright with the Cardinals. Buster Posey appears to be a candidate for that with the Giants. I'm going off the top of my head. But I think we will see Joey Votto with Cincinnati. Jacob DeGrom might be like that with the Mets. It's a shame what happened with Mookie Betts, for example, with the Red Sox. There's a franchise signature player, but that is part of the modern game. So we'll see less Carl Yastrzemskis and Cal Ripkins and Al Kalines. We'll see less of that than we did in previous generations, but I don't think it's gone completely.
You mentioned Mookie Betts and, of course, Nolan Arenado in that same category now.
Yeah.
Mike Trout and the Angels. Do you feel like Mike Trout and the Angels are going to be married until Trout retires?
Well, it certainly seems that way. He's on a long-term deal. And there's a sense of urgency, I hope, with the Angels. There certainly is around baseball. It's the nature of baseball. Ken Griffey Jr. got to the World Series. Never. Barry Bonds got there once. The two best position players of their generation. Even if you just stop the clock on Barry Bonds in 1998, Bonds and Griffey were the two transcendent stars of that generation. It's the nature of baseball that it's impossible to say, here's the best player, and he will lead this team deep into the playoffs or to the World Series. But in the case of Mike Trout, he's played, as you know, only three postseason games in his now decade-long career, and the Angels were swept out of that series. So he's never gotten past the division series. Never been on the field when his team even won a postseason game. So here's a guy who, by acclamation, has been the best player in his sport for several years, and yet is less well known to the public than people who have never been the MVP in the NFL or the NBA. And that's a problem for baseball. They want to get in the center stage, but what are you going to do? You can't just start the playoffs in Anaheim. It doesn't work that way.
How do you think baseball can replicate what happened with the Mariners and Ken Griffey Jr.? And that was kind of the boom, right? Like, there was that excitement, and now baseball has two of the top stars of the game, Fernando Tatis Jr. and Mike Trout, both on the West Coast now. So how can baseball almost replicate that excitement level that you're talking about that Ken Griffey Jr. was able to have back when he was with the Mariners?
Well, Ken was an electric player, as Fernando Tatis is. There was something very winning about him. The nickname "The Kid" fit him. And he was threatening at that time. The record was Roger Maris's 61. It looked like he might be in that conversation, along with Maguire and Sosa, obviously through the rearview mirror regarding Maguire-Sosa bonds. We look at it differently. So there were different dynamics around the game then. And in the 1990s, even with all the labor problems that plagued baseball, it still held a more favorable position in terms of television viewership. If you look at the ratings of the 1997 World Series between Cleveland and the Marlins, and then the 1997 NBA Finals with Michael Jordan's Bulls, and in 98, the Bulls again against the Jazz, those World Series ratings are comparable to NBA Finals ratings, maybe in some cases individual games higher. So baseball hadn't sacrificed that position to the NBA. I'm not sure the NBA will ever regain that position because so many of their games now are on cable TV. And as great as LeBron and Steph Curry and other magnificent NBA stars are, they haven't captured the public imagination like Michael Jordan did, and perhaps no one ever will. So you get a different landscape. It isn't just a matter of saying, well, you know, Mike Trout and Fernando Tatis in their own way are as appealing as Ken Griffey Jr. That may be true, but the circumstances are different. And remember, Griffey's Mariners did get to the postseason. And in the first postseason that included the wild card, 1995, they won an incredible wild card series against the Yankees, with an image of Griffey sliding home with the winning run and extra innings in the deciding game five in front of a wild home crowd. One of the things that kind of seals people, athletes, in the public imagination isn't just statistical performance, it's moments. Do we have a moment, an image in the mind's eye that we identify with that player? Sadly, there is no such moment now for Mike Trout. He's got time, and so does Fernando Tatis. Tatis has plenty of time.
And Bob, you've kind of touched on Mike Trout and Fernando Tatis, but why is there such a historical disagreement between the owners and the MLBPA?
Well, a lot of it goes back to the days when the owners absolutely were in the wrong, and the players absolutely, under Marvin Miller and then under Don Fear and Gene Orza, were in the right. And I think a lot of that institutional resentment remains. And Tony Clark, who now heads the Players Association, may be of a mind that if I am not just as tough, if I don't hold the line just as staunchly as Miller, Fear, and Orza did, then the players will lose confidence in me. History will not be kind to me. But circumstances vary. The players have won almost every important matter of principle. It used to be a matter of principle, or even in some cases, morality, the battles that the players fought and won against the owners. But now it should be viewed in an enlightened sense as a business deal, a negotiation. It is a tough negotiation, often is. We understand that. It should be an adversarial relationship, but it should also be one in which both parties can see their mutual interest. The players are upset over the fact that the owners obviously manipulate service time. Here's a guy who's going to be a big star. We're not going to bring him up till May 1st. We're not going to start the season with him so that the clock doesn't start on him being arbitration eligible or free agent eligible. Okay, we see what you're doing. What can we negotiate in return for removing that as a ploy? What can we give you and what can you give us? It's a negotiation. It shouldn't be a holy war anymore. But a lot of that DNA, that holy war DNA, remains part of the dynamic every time they sit down at the table.
How crucial is this upcoming CBA deal in the history of the game?
It's very important because given baseball trying to maintain and grow its position in the public imagination, especially with younger viewers, and with the pandemic circumstances, it would be horrible from a public relations standpoint if they had another work stoppage, whether it was a strike or a lockout, or if they did what they did last summer, almost unmindful of the public dealing with a pandemic, and they're making public their little internal squabbles. That just can't be good for the game. They've got to look at their mutual interests. And one of the things that's in their mutual interest is to keep whatever their adversarial positions are behind closed doors. Work it out in the negotiations. Don't take it public.
What would you say is the best thing going for baseball right now?
The best thing going is that there's a huge collection of really good young players. Think back to the days of A-Rod when he was a shortstop, Derek Jeter, Nomar Garciaparra, briefly Miguel Tejada, who was involved, we now know, with PEDs, but he was the MVP of the American League at one time. Barry Larkin, who would go to the Hall of Fame in the National League. Ozzie Smith finishing up his career in the National League with the Cardinals. This is the best group of shortstops I can think of since then. And most of the names you would cite still have plenty of prime years remaining. And that's not to mention the guys that we already have mentioned. Outfielders like Mike Trout or Bellinger or Yelich or people like that. And Hall of Fame bound pitchers like Jacob DeGrom and others. So they have the players. Their big problem is obviously pace of play. Baseball's supposed to have a pleasing leisurely pace, and for too long now, it's had a lethargic pace. And there are multiple factors. I don't want to lay the blame on any one, but one of the factors is that the reliance on analytics, which may be good for giving teams a certain competitive edge, it's terrible for baseball as an entertainment product. And they're going to have to address that particular problem again, without sounding like a broken record here, with the idea, hey, this is in our mutual interest. Improving this circumstance isn't just an owner's issue. It should be a player's issue as well, because the popularity of the game grows and the revenue grows. The larger the pie, the better off everybody is.
What can baseball do to speed up the game, in your opinion?
I favor a pitch clock with nobody on base. 20-second pitch clock, or whatever research indicates is the median number that they should aim for. I think they should eliminate the use of video within the game. Study all the video you want, but you can't go back down into the tunnel between at-bats. That's what leads guys to step out after almost every pitch. Why? Because somewhere in their mind, they have a different approach if the count is 1-0 as opposed to 0-1 against this pitcher. I don't think you want to go much further than the rule that says a reliever has to face at least three hitters unless he concludes the inning before that. But I do favor limiting the number of pitchers on a roster. 10 pitchers on a roster used to be standard forever, and baseball got by very well. And there were famous Hall of Fame relievers and closers during that period of time. If you had to be more efficient in your use of relievers, if you couldn't approach a game with the idea that going in, we're going to use five pitchers, even if the game is 3-2 and we win, we're going to use five pitchers. That slows the game down. Another thing I think they could do is mandate that you have to have two fielders on either side of second base. Now, the shortstop could move to the point where his left foot was touching the shortstop side of the second base bag. And the second baseman could do the same thing with his right foot. But you have to have two fielders on either side of second base. That would eliminate extreme shifts. It would mean that more ground balls would go through than presently do. So you get the ball in play more. That's action. That's guys running. That's a guy trying to go from first to third. It would also make some hitters more inclined to spray the ball around rather than trying to lift it and hit it over the shift and out of the park. If the shift is going to take base hits away, then part of the mindset is to hit it over the shift. That's not the only reason. Analytics has told front offices and managers and players themselves that if you get 6 hits and 3 of them are home runs, that might be better than 10 hits in a game and 6 of them are singles. So there's a difference in approach there. But if you eliminated the shifts and made hitting the ball through the infield a more viable option, then I think it would change in a subtle way, would change the approach, which would limit the number of strikeouts, because when guys are swinging for the fences, there's going to be a lot of swinging and missing. And I think a lot of times people think it's only home runs, walks, or strikeouts. But if you've got that much non-contact, you're going to have a lot of longer counts. You're going to have fewer at-bats resolved on the first or second pitch, and a lot more at-bats that go to 2-2 or 3-2 with foul balls mixed in, all of which extends the game. If you've got a better chance to get a base hit by just making solid contact, I think it would have a ripple effect on all those things I just mentioned.
How can owners or even front office staff reward guys if that's what is a belief that can bring the excitement level and to slow down or speed up the game, rather? How can these teams reward the players that do get the 6 singles instead of the 3 home runs? Because it's that belief, right, that if you hit 3 home runs a game, you'll get paid more versus a guy that has 3 singles in a game. So how can front offices kind of reward those players that don't just hit the home runs and the strikeouts, but have that small ball component?
Well, power, OPS, the recognition that on base and slugging percentage are the two most important offensive factors, that's always going to be the case. The slugger who hits 45 homers and bats 280 is always going to be, all things being even close to equal, is always going to get paid more than the guy who hits 315 but without power. So that's always going to be there to some extent. But the more the game is opened up, the more speed and running the bases becomes a factor, the more emphasis on defense, because there's more balls in play, so defense becomes proportionately more important, then the greater the value of those players. Here's something else that I haven't heard anyone else mention. I'm sure others have had the idea. I'm not saying it's my idea alone, but here's something that would help with improving the excitement of the game. One of the worst unintended consequences of instant replay, in addition to micromanaging calls in the fourth inning, when the intention of instant replay was to avoid egregious errors in postseason games or at important junctures. Some guy loses a Galarraga of the Tigers, loses a perfect game because unfortunately Jim Joyce misses a call at first base on what would have been the last out in the ninth inning. That's what replay was really designed for. And now we're getting delays to micromanage things that really are not that consequential. But another aspect is this. Infielders are being taught now to hold the tag on a runner sliding in, not because he's missed the bag, not because he's overslid the bag and he's really off the bag, but because for a micro millisecond, his body comes off the bag because of contact after the slide. He's still hovering above the bag, and he's clearly safe. And he's been safe for the first 100 years or more of baseball, and everybody knows it, and no one ever objected to it. But now, because you can go frame by frame, you might find this millisecond where his body is off the bag. That makes teams even less inclined to try and steal. Analytics has told them that you have to have a very high stolen base percentage for the steal to be worth it, because they don't think the possibility of the extra base is worth giving up the potential out. That's why the sacrifice is in eclipse. Analytics has told baseball people that, except in certain specific circumstances, we don't want to give up the out just to gain the guy going from first to second. Well, the stolen base becomes even more problematic when you can actually be safe but be called out because of instant replay. They should just say replay can't be used for that purpose. If the guy's really off the bag, the umpire should be able to see it. Or if replay shows that he's really off the bag, fine, we'll call him out. But we're not going to do this ridiculous thing that literally for the entire history of baseball until the last 5 or 6 years, nobody even thought about. It's silly.
What can the game of baseball do, not just to grow the game, but protect and preserve the core values of it?
Well, I think one of the things that's important is to recognize the distinction, even in a modern era, even as baseball correctly tries to adjust for modern circumstances, there's a difference between baseball and other sports. It's part of its appeal. You can't just simply have playoff qualifying in baseball. The regular season is too long, and it has to be meaningful. So they're going to expand the playoffs. There's no question. The question is, how thoughtfully do they go about it? To just simply say we're going to add X number of teams, and therefore more fan bases will be involved, more teams will have a chance, we'll have more postseason games, it'll be more fun. And I've heard people liken it to the NCAA tournament. Talk about apples and oranges. Mm. You can't play 162 games and not have a team win its division, maybe win over 100 games, and then be thrown in on virtually equal footing with some team that won 83 games and qualified as the fourth wild card or whatever it's going to be.
Right.
So the format that I favor, and I heard this first from Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, right now there are 5 playoff teams for each league, 2 wild cards, and 2 wild cards is better than 1. Because at least put a premium on winning the division and put you at some sort of disadvantage for being the wild card, because you had to win that one-off wild card game to get into the division series. Well, now, why not expand the field to 7? 7 per league. But all 3 division winners are exempt from the wild card round. One of the proposals I've heard is that only the division winner with the best record gets a first round bye. And the other 2 division winners get tossed in along with 4 wild cards. Well, the last time they played a full season, 2019, the 3 American League division winners all won more than 100 games. That's insane. If it doesn't make any difference or makes no real practical difference, if you win the division or you get thrown in with the wild cards, then it isn't just less dramatic at the end of a season. It's actually less dramatic and meaningful in June or July. If Yankee and Red Sox fans know, well, both of them are going to make the playoffs one way or the other, or Cub and Cardinal fans, Giant and Dodger fans, then those series in the middle of the year carry less meaning. Mm-hmm. So the idea is, how do you respect the tradition and the nature of baseball while also modernizing? So here's the idea I heard from Reinsdorf. You have 4 wild cards. All 3 division winners get a bye. The number 1 wild card plays the number 4 wild card, and 2 plays 3 in 1 game knockouts. The 2 survivors then play in a 1 game knockout. The survivor then is the 4th participant in the division series and plays the division winner that had the best overall record. Now, what does that give you? It gives you a guaranteed 6 elimination games in the wild card round. Elimination games is what television wants. All the research tells us that that's a big plus for television. You've got 6 elimination games, 3 in each league. The wild card round is over quickly so that the division winners can't complain about getting rusty. But it does give them the huge advantage of not having to win 2 games against teams that are at least in some sense of playoff quality, and it allows them to get their pitching in order, even if they had to go to the end of the season to win the division, get their pitching in order for the start of the playoffs. The survivor that won the 2 wild card games has to have used a number of pitchers to get to that point. They're at a further disadvantage against the division winner. And if they wanted to, they could take the division series, which right now is the only one that's best of 5, LCS and World Series best of 7, we know that even in a best of 7, home field advantage isn't necessarily determinative. In the 2019 World Series, the road team won every game, but it is a small advantage at least. And a best of seven, while the lesser team sometimes wins, a best of seven is a fairer test than a best of five. So why not make the division series the only one guaranteed to include the third best division winner and the wild card? Why not make the division series also a best of seven? And if you have to shorten the regular season to 156 games from 162, well, that's only one three-game home series per team. And any revenue lost, and in some cases for teams that are out of the playoffs, it's not going to be that much toward the end of the season. Any revenue lost is made up, more than made up, by the additional television revenue from postseason. And then when you play those division series, the wild card survivor playing the number one division winner, instead of the standard 2-3-2 arrangement, make it 2-2-3 so that it further advantages the team that had the best record during the regular season. Now, you didn't count on this extensive an answer, but I'm giving you everything I've got here. Now, if you still with me, Alex?
Yes. Okay. I'm waiting for the book because I know
I just wrote a chapter off the top of my head.
I know. So
go ahead.
I texted you, this is I think 2 years ago now, when I listened to your audio book that came out, and I loved it. And I can't wait for the next one.
Well, there'll be a next one eventually. Here's the thing. Some people will say, well, what if one of the wildcard teams won 98 games and another wildcard team got in winning 84 games? Is that fair? Hmm. Yes, it's fair. And here's the reason. The divisional race has to exist for a reason. It used to be you could go all the way to the end, win 100 games, lose by one game, and that was that. That was the drama and meaning of a pennant race. So if failing to win your division when you have somewhere between 156 and 162 games to do it, if that throws you into a crapshoot wild card round, well, fine. At least you're in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And winning the division has greater meaning. So what I just described not only increases the number of playoff teams, it actually puts a greater emphasis on the traditional meaning of a pennant race. It's a nod both to a modern situation and a traditional situation. It strengthens both the tradition and the 21st century version of baseball simultaneously. That's the difference between a thoughtful approach and something you just throw against the wall and say, hey, it's new. Everybody should embrace it. Otherwise, you're just somebody saying, get off my lawn. Mm-hmm. No, you should think about it. If you're going to do it in a thoughtful way that acknowledges the difference between baseball and other sports, even as baseball appropriately changes and modernizes.
Well, you're one of the best, and we want to say thanks so much for coming on the podcast today. We appreciate you.
I hope I didn't wear you out. I think I wore myself out.
Thank you again.